content for this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we'll begin today with The Dieting Myth That Just Won't Die, written by Michaeline Duclef. Back in the early 1970s, psychologists at Northwestern University performed an experiment that, on the surface, looked like a child's fantasy. The researchers gathered 45 college women and asked some of them to drink a milkshake, or two. Then they placed 3 pints of ice cream in front of each woman and asked her to taste each one. Afterward, they told each participant to help yourself to any of the remaining ice cream, as she wished. The researchers wrote in the Journal of Personality, "Finally, and this was key, each woman completed a survey meant to measure how much she dieted or restrained her eating outside of the treats she had just consumed." The findings were dramatic. On average, the women who said they didn't diet or have weight concerns ate less ice cream if they drank at least 1 milkshake. The first sweet treat satiated their hunger. But for the women who dieted and felt worried about their weight, the milkshake appeared to unleash a hidden hunger. On average, they ate 66% more ice cream after the milkshake than they did without it. From these data, the researchers devised a bold new theory. Dieting and weight concerns make people overeat and gain weight. Dieting remains pervasive in American culture, but the milkshake study and similar ones that followed nonetheless reshaped many Americans' views of dieting and obesity. Experts concluded that all types of eating disorders, including anorexia, binge eating, and bulimia, can be brought on by intentionally trying to reduce the number of calories that you eat. Some scientists believe that dietary restraint causes obesity, too. This line of research inspired treatments for eating disorders, helped launch an anti-diet movement, fueled the trend of so-called intuitive eating, and shifted how many parents raise their kids to think about food. But more evidence, recent evidence, suggests that attempting to restrict one's food intake typically doesn't have such dire consequences after all. The notion that trying to diet causes eating disorders and obesity makes some sense. There's the idea if you're finding yourself thinking about food, trying to restrict what you're eating, or trying not to overeat, then you're developing an eating disorder mentality, Michael Lowe, a psychologist at Drexel University, told me. The theory is also inherently appealing in that most people don't like avoiding tasty food. They can easily believe that doing so would be harmful. No wonder, then, that the idea spread far among clinicians and everyday Americans. Social media supercharged the theory enough that many people now believe that placing any limits on your diet could be dangerous or harmful, Ashley Gearhart, a psychologist at the University of Michigan, told me. Many parents share the belief that letting kids follow their own appetites will create healthy attitudes toward food. Taken to its logical extreme, that way of thinking means that in a lot of circles now, if you don't let your kids have unlimited access to ultra-processed foods, it's a bad thing. Catherine Balankin, a registered dietitian at the University of Buffalo, told me. Such ideas spread even as researchers were uncovering major flaws in early studies on the link between dietary restrictions and eating disorders. Those experiments didn't use a consistent definition of dietary restraint and never tested whether it actually caused eating disorders or overeating. They could only say that those behaviors occurred together. Plus, many studies lumped together several types of eating disorders or didn't separate participants with obesity from those with low body weights. Scientists, including the ones who ran the 1975 milkshake study, also relied on self-reports or surveys to quantify how much a participant dieted, assuming that people who said that they greatly restricted their consumption really did take in fewer calories. But decades later, when scientists gave the same surveys to new participants and measured their caloric intake, they found that the surveys simply didn't correlate with the calorie restriction. Eric Stice, a psychologist at Stanford, who led some of these measurement studies, told me, people whom such surveys would label, quote, high dieters, end quote, may not have been dieting at all. Stice found, in one of his studies, a so-called high dieter ate, on average, 23 calories fewer a day than a low dieter. That's not like eating 4 peanuts each day and saying, you're on a diet, he said. By the 2000s, scientists began to run randomized, controlled trials that could accurately test the model proposed back in the 70s. In one series of studies, people were prescribed personalized diets aimed at reducing calorie consumption and taught effective ways to adhere to their eating plans. After 6 months, those volunteers lost about 10% of their body weight on average, compared with the 1% that the control group lost. And the increased dieting didn't exacerbate participants' eating disorder symptoms. In fact, it decreased their binge eating, and they felt less concerned about their body size, perhaps in part because their body size had decreased. In the past decade, psychologists at Yale School of Medicine have run similar randomized controlled studies on people who had already been diagnosed with binge eating disorder and obesity. And again, on average, calorie restriction reduced binge eating. Participants' eating disorder symptoms worsened only occasionally, with no more than in the control group. In at least one paper, eating disorder symptoms improved far more among people in the restricted group than in the control group. In another, weight loss led to remission of binge eating in nearly three-quarters of the participants. The scientific consensus has emerged after these and similar studies is much more nuanced than the one Pro offered 50 years ago, even though that one still has significant traction in American culture today. Dietary restriction is not necessarily all good or all bad, but different degrees may be helpful or harming to different people. Sydney Yorko, a psychologist at the Yale School of Medicine, who contributed to the recent trials there, told me in an email. For example, she said, cutting back on food would never be recommended for people diagnosed with anorexia nervosa. And even for people without an eating disorder, extreme restriction that often coincides with self-directed dieting is largely unhealthy and unhelpful, Yurko wrote. The new generation of experiments has also uncovered a surprising way to prevent future eating disorders in high-risk adolescents and young women: a small amount of effective dietary restraint. One 2021 meta-analysis found that teaching people about healthy eating habits, including how to curb a tendency to overeat, prevents the future development of eating disorders. From this perspective, the milkshake study looks quite different. 50 years ago, psychologists concluded that dietary restraint caused the women to overeat the pints of ice cream. But the modern interpretation suggests that the reverse was likely true for many of the participants. An underlying tendency to overeat drove the women to try to diet. In hindsight, the timing of the milkshake study is almost prophetic. Around the late 1970s, the food environment in America began to change rapidly, Lowe, the Drexel psychologist, told me. The availability of fast food, restaurants, and high-sugar, high-fat foods began to explode. Food became much more difficult to resist, even when Americans weren't hungry. People suddenly had to restrain their eating much more in order to maintain their weight. More people began to gain weight. And by the early 80s, the country had entered the first stage of the current obesity epidemic. Today, the average American consumes about half their calories from ultra-processed foods. The precise bounds of the category generate debate among some scientists, but they generally agree that such foods are highly refined, manufactured in industrial factories, and calorically dense. Studies have found that diets high in these foods can coax people to consume hundreds of extra calories a day. And when people binge eat, they tend to do so only with ultra-processed foods. Recently, scientists and government leaders have begun warning Americans about the potential harms of eating too much ultra-processed food, including an elevated risk of diabetes, certain cancers, and depression. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has declared war on added sugars, and as of this year, the National Dietary Guidelines advise against eating highly processed foods. In reality, the study of this kind of food is just getting started. But if Americans are ever really to understand just how such foods affect us, now is the time to abandon the misguided lessons of the milkshake study. Maybe then we can explore how we might develop a truly healthy relationship with the tantalizing food around us. Our second story, Why America's Catholic Bishops Started Sounding Liberal, written by Francis X. Rocha. Not so long ago, when U.S. Catholic leaders said something political, they tended to sound like conservatives. American bishops' most prominent policy statements focused on three issues: same-sex marriage, contraception, and, above all, abortion. Their frequently stated opposition to all three put them at odds with not just the left, but also many Catholics. It even created tension with Rome. Since Donald Trump's re-election, however, the church in the United States has been sounding more liberal. Its teaching hasn't changed, but the president's second term has shifted the bishop's attention. The most urgent political concern for America's Catholic leaders is no longer abortion. It's immigration. The issue has featured in their agenda for a while. After all, the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that wealthy countries should welcome refugees and economic migrants to the extent they are able. But now immigration dominates U.S. Catholic leaders' public messaging. In November, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops published a rare special message decrying the Trump administration's indiscriminate mass deportation. The day of Trump's State of the Union address, 18 bishops from border states urged the administration to implement a range of reforms and to honor migrants' wish to apply for asylum. Following the government's crackdown in Minnesota, bishops gathered in the state to support migrants and denounce mass deportations. USCCB lawyers told the Supreme Court last month that the president's plan to revoke birthright citizenship would be an affront to human dignity. Sensing the church's growing emphasis on immigration, Democrats recently invoked Catholic teaching to criticize the GOP. A few years ago, that sentence would have read like it had a typo. Chico Noguchi, the spokesperson for the U.S. Catholic bishops, acknowledged that shifting national politics can affect which issues the bishops prioritize. But she told me that they will speak up to defend the sanctity and dignity of human life, no matter who occupies the White House. Indeed, Catholic teaching frequently crosses the U.S. partisan divide, but this is hardly the first time that American bishops have been critical of conservative views. In 1983, USCCB advocated for a halt to nuclear weapons testing and production, opposing the stance of the Reagan administration. 3 years later, as the GOP pushed for economic deregulation, the bishops published a letter arguing that free markets alone can't ensure fairness and human dignity. In the same period, American bishops challenged the left on abortion, even though the issue wasn't as central for the U.S. hierarchy then as it would later become. One of the most outspoken Catholic opponents of abortion was Cardinal John O'Connor, who served as the Archbishop of New York from 1984 to his death in 2000, and who often addressed the issue in public forums. For the next 20 years, bishops focused much of their public advocacy on right-coded concerns, restricting abortion, regulating other issues of sexual and medical ethics, and protecting religious freedom. Until this past November, the previous time the USCCB published a special message was in 2013, when the group condemned the Obama administration's coercive mandate compelling employers to offer health insurance that covered contraception. 2 years later, the president of the USCCB called the legislation of same-sex marriage a tragic error. In 2019, the conference approved an introduction to a voter guide that identified opposition to abortion as the group's preeminent priority. The bishops amplified their criticism of the left after the election of Joe Biden, the first Catholic president in 60 years. Their rebuke centered on abortion, a principal issue in Biden's campaign. On the day of his inauguration in 2021, the USCCB's leader lamented Biden's support for policies that would advance moral evils. Legalized abortion was the first such policy he mentioned. Echoing the 2004 debate about carry, a committee of U.S. bishops discussed in 2021 whether to instruct priests to deny communion to Catholic politicians who supported legalized abortion, including Biden and Nancy Pelosi. They decided against it, but only after the Vatican, then under Pope Francis, intervened to warn them about the division it would cause. Francis's opposition to abortion was unequivocal. He once likened it to hiring a hitman, but he complained that some Catholics overemphasized the issue. As the bishops have recalibrated their priorities in response to changing national politics, the U.S. hierarchy and Rome have become more aligned than they were for much of Francis's pontificate. In September, Pope Leo, Francis's successor and the first American pope, told reporters that being truly pro-life requires opposing not only abortions, but also the inhumane treatment of immigrants in the United States. He later endorsed the bishop's special message on immigration, calling it very important. U.S. bishops may have the support of the Vatican, but they may also put themselves at odds with the majority of their flock. A poll from November found that 54% of Catholics support the detention and deportation of unauthorized immigrants on a broad scale. Although that support might have waned since the Trump administration's campaign in Minneapolis, the finding, mirrors the disconnect between bishops and laity over abortion. 57% of Catholics think the procedure should be legal in all or most cases, according to a January survey by the Pew Research Center. Unsurprisingly, some Catholics have pushed back against the Church's criticism of Trump's immigration policies. Kelsey Reinhart, the head of the conservative advocacy group Catholic Vote, argued last month that bishops have focused on migrants' rights and Christians' duty to help them while treating enforcement as morally suspect by default. Such teaching, Reinhart wrote, has left many Catholics thinking they must choose between fidelity to the Church and the basic belief that laws matter. Noguchi, the USCCB spokesperson, pushed back on the critique. The bishops have emphasized repeatedly that human dignity and national security are not in conflict, she told me. Both are possible if people of goodwill work together. Those who want church leaders to soften their message on immigration will almost certainly be disappointed. Leo's most powerful statement on the subject could come on July 4th. Despite the hopes of many American Catholics, Leo will not mark the country's 250th anniversary in his native land. Instead, he will spend the day on the Mediterranean island of Lampedusa, a way station for migrants seeking asylum in Europe. The trip will be one of the clearest demonstrations of continuity between Leo and Francis, who made Lampedusa the destination of his first papal trip. There, Francis embraced the cause of immigrants, a message that Leo and the Church in the U.S. are poised to repeat. Next, why I stopped forcing my kid to share. written by Janisa Watts. The trouble began with the truck. We usually went to the playground with only snacks, water and some Cheez-Its or an applesauce pouch. But one day my son wanted to bring a toy. So we arrived with his little yellow excavator truck, which he rolled in zigzags on the sidewalk, then tried to dig up mulch and dump it back on the ground in a pile. He was three and suddenly the most popular kid on the playground. A few kids circled him around him as he played, staring at the truck. Their parents stared at me. I knew what everyone was thinking. The other kids wanted a turn. The parents expected me to tell my son to share, and my own child was oblivious, delightfully zooming his truck through the dirt. If he didn't offer to share and I didn't force him to, the other parents would think he was spoiled. But he loved that truck. Did he have to give it up just because this ring of kids wanted him to? One child kept trying to snatch the truck away. No, his mother said. He tried running at the toy. She had to grab him and hold him back. Finally, he released a scream that went on and on, like a dial tone. I felt terrible. Okay, I told my son, let's share. I pulled the truck from his hands and dragged him wailing over to the swings. His tears are good, I told myself. He needs to learn how to share, and this is his lesson. Parents make this choice multiple times every day. It's part of helping kids grow up to be responsible adults. But for weeks, I kept revisiting what had happened. I had made another child happy by making my own child suffer. Of course, I wanted to raise a child with a sense of fairness, someone generous who cared about others' feelings. But was forcing him to share like that right or helpful? As a girl, I was taught that one always has to share, and I grew up into a people pleaser. I was the easygoing friend, the one who stayed at the club long after I wanted to go home to sleep, the that's okay friend who never admitted if my feelings had been hurt, the helpful volunteer who'd drive an hour out of my way so that my friend didn't have to pay for an Uber home. Silencing my own needs has always been easier for me than telling someone else no. Was I raising my son to be the exact same way? We tell our toddlers to share, but why? One friend told me she saw sharing as transactional. She wanted her son, an only child, to understand that if he wanted to play with other kids' toys, he was going to have to share his own. That seemed reasonable enough. Another friend told me that she believed sharing was an expression of care and empathy, and acknowledged that the human experience is not singular, but shared. But you can't expect a three-year-old to understand that. There is evidence that kindness and altruism are innate, or at least demonstrated by even the youngest children. Researchers at the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences found, in a trial of almost 119-month-olds, that even children who were hungry themselves would give a treat to a stranger lacking food. Researchers have also found that children as young as 12 months can express worry for a person who is suffering and occasionally step in to console them. Children may also point to an object if they notice an adult looking for it, showing a desire to help. But children are not just short adults. Eileen Kennedy Moore, a clinical psychologist who specializes in parenting and child development, reminded me. They really think differently than we do, she said. Children don't develop what's called a theory of mind, a cognitive ability to understand that other people have feelings and perspectives different from their own, until age four. If you tell a two-year-old to share, Kennedy Moore said, they simply won't understand, because they're likely to see their toys as literally part of themselves. What they hear is, slice off part of your body and give it to someone else. And this makes absolutely no sense to them. Around age four, this changes, because a child can at least understand that what you mean when you tell them to share, but they still may not want to do it. Self-determination theory holds that humans have three innate psychological needs: to feel like they have autonomy, to feel like they have competence to get things done, and to feel connected to other people. Sharing touches on all three things. Maryam Abdullah, a developmental psychologist, told me, sharing is an independent decision to provide some goodness with someone else. The key word here, however, is independent. Forcing a kid to share risks teaching them that generosity is something that I am coerced to do, and it doesn't feel good, Abdallah said. They will feel that someone more powerful than me is telling me to part with the very thing that I love right now. That takes away a basic need of autonomy. This doesn't mean that you should just let your kid keep their toys themselves and ignore other kids, however. If you encourage that kind of behavior, they probably wouldn't make any friends. Fortunately, there's an alternative. Instead of telling a kid to share, Kennedy Moore said, tell them to take turns. Around the ages of 4 or 5, children can learn about dividing things evenly, Kennedy Moore said. They also begin to appreciate fairness, to want to uphold and enforce it, and to understand that there are social expectations to collaborate with others. Above all, they understand that taking turns means they'll eventually get the toy back. Taking turns, Abdallah said, involves a form of fairness and justice that all of us come to expect and depend on in our social interactions. Kennedy Moore told me I should stop worrying about preventing my son from being a people pleaser. Don't think about outcomes, think about skills, she said. We want to help our kids to develop the skills they're going to need to create a life that is meaningful and satisfying to them. That entails learning both to speak up for themselves and to compromise with others. Sometimes a child will have to do something he doesn't like, and that's just how the world works. Of course, the kid might be frustrated, but frustration is temporary and tolerable. A couple of weeks ago, I took my son and his friends to our local recreation center to play. All three boys had remote-controlled monster trucks and wanted to bring them along. On the way, they raced the trucks down the sidewalk, the wheels surging over hardened snow, while I played referee, making sure the trucks didn't go into the street. The play area was deserted except for two brothers. Of course, they too wanted to play with a monster truck. And of course, neither my son nor his friends wanted to give theirs up. One of the boys started crying. Can that boy have a turn? I asked my son. He shook his head and no, and continued playing. Shame clouded my mind, but I decided not to force him and to wait and see what happened. The other mother picked up her kid's coats. Time to go, she announced, and began trying to drag them away. But then I watched as my son walked to the crying boy and handed him the truck. A few minutes later, his two friends shared theirs as well. I turned to the boy's mom, and we smiled at each other. She got to put the coats back down, and we sat side by side, watching the kids relish their new friends, the reward of their decision to share. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.